In this session, we'll be hearing from two speakers and one respondent. Our first paper will be given by Ken Robson, who received a PhD in philosophy from Stanford and is currently teaching philosophy at Utah State University. His paper is entitled, Is God the Creator of Natural and Moral Law? Following his paper, Kim McCall, student in philosophy at Stanford, will present a paper entitled, The Moral Imperatives of a Finite God. The response to these papers will be given by Doug Johnson, studying philosophy at the University of Illinois. It's doubtful that, given the fact that we have two papers and a response, that we'll be able to have a question-answer series, but we're grateful in any event for the two papers. Dr. Robson.
In Plato's Euthyphro dialogue, Socrates asks a question of Euthyphro that separates two major theological traditions in Western civilization. The simple question is this: do the gods love piety because it is pious, or is it pious because the gods love it? Let me mention that question again, and then I'm going to try to explain it. Do the gods love piety because it is pious, or is it pious because the gods love it? The importance of this question will not be immediately apparent to all, as it was not to Euthyphro. Suitably generalized and briefly characterized, the two fundamentally different views are these. The first one I'm going to call the independent tradition, that the gods love something because it is what it is. In this tradition, the idea is that there are moral ideals or values that are independent of the gods, that have always existed, that do not change, that cannot be brought into existence or go out of existence. They can be discovered, and they can be recognized by God, but otherwise they are unaffected by God. If so, such values are not created by God, nor are they dependent on God. Their values are intrinsic, and they do not come into existence through the instrumentality of God. God discovers these values and recommends them to others because they are right, or good in and of themselves. Their goodness or rightness is totally separate from God. In this tradition, the gods love piety or holiness because it is pious or holy in and of itself. They did not create the piety, and a thing or event is not made pious or holy through an act of the will of God. The piety of the thing or event is pious in and of itself, and it would remain pious even if there were no gods, or even if the gods didn't recognize the value of piety. Even the gods are governed and measured by such eternal ideals. Not only is this true of moral ideals or values, it would similarly be true of eternal laws or natural laws, since the conception of them is similar in this way. They are independent of gods or God. They inhere or reside in something eternal. They cannot be changed by the gods or anyone else, and all things are governed by them, including the gods. Now, that was the one tradition that Plato posed in this question. The other tradition, which I'm calling the dependent tradition, suggests that all values or ideals come into existence through the instrumentality of God or the gods. They are created by them. They are dependent on them. They arise from the nature of God or through the intellect or will of God. And since they do, they could even be changed by God. Everything that is good only because God says it is good. Similarly with all things that are right. In this tradition, the rightness of all things is dependent on God. One of the reasons that this is so is that God is the creator of all things, has made all things out of nothing, or has made all things ex nihilo, as theologians say. In this tradition, there tends to be a radical discontinuity between God and the world, between God and man, between the Creator and creation, between necessary being, which is only God, could not not exist, and contingent being, which is dependent on God. And contingent being includes man in this tradition, the world, and everything else. The natural laws are fashioned by God to suit his purposes. They might have been made differently. They might even be changed if it should please God. Something is pious, because the gods love it, and their loving it makes it pious. And that is the only reason why it is pious. Now, if my characterization of these two traditions has been reasonably clear, it is possible to see that the consequences of these two views will be fundamentally different. In the first, or independent, tradition, it will be difficult and maybe incoherent to maintain that God is completely omnipotent and unconditioned. It goes without saying that one cannot maintain in the first tradition that God is the creator of everything, whether ex nihilo or otherwise. In the second tradition, it will be difficult to avoid blaming God for all of the evil in the universe. That's in the dependent tradition. It will furthermore be easy to claim that moral values could change if God chose to change them. Indeed, this is the position that Occam takes. We then end up with a ontologically relativistic ethic. It's relativistic to the will or whim of God, and could be changed, although God may not change it, because one may conceive of him as an unchanging God. Now, before exploring further the consequences of these two traditions, it's interesting to see who has adopted the one or the other. What, for example, was Plato's own position and his answer to his own question? In the Euthyphro, it is clear that Plato defends the independent tradition. He believes that piety is loved by the gods because it is pious, and they have recognized that pious, did not bring it into existence. This position is consistent with the Platonic theory of ideas that is developed more fully in the Meno and the Phaedo dialogues, among other places. And it is also consistent with Plato's own story of the origin of the universe in the Timaeus dialogue. In the Timaeus dialogue, God is called a demiurge. A demiurge is an organizer, a master craftsman, someone who works with things but who does not create everything. And in this dialogue, the demiurge must use a pre-existent chaos, something that is already around, not created by the world, and mold it according to certain pre-existent forms, which are uncreated and indestructible. Even the elements had forces in them that, quote, did indeed show faint traces of themselves, but were altogether in such a condition as one may expect to find wherever God is absent. End quote. God, or the demiurge, takes these and molds a world that is, as far as possible, the fairest and best. There is no concept here of an ex nihilo, out of nothing creation. There is no hint that God is the only necessary being, in the sense that he is the only being that could not not exist, that must exist, that has eternally existed, and has not come into existence and cannot go out of existence, as contingent beings or things or people could. In short, there are forces in nature that God can utilize and organize, but these forces are eternal and self-existent. There are moral values that God knows, but they are independent of God's knowing them and willing them. What has been the main Orthodox Christian tradition on this issue? By and large, I would claim it is the second tradition, the dependent tradition. This is because of the acceptance of the ex nihilo creation in response to Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, and the challenge of the ideas of Philo. This process was solidified by the time of St. Augustine. An additional factor in this same tradition was the desire to defend the absolute, unlimited omnipotence of God. God has made all things, and God can do all things. All things are what they are because God has made them that way. The natural laws are God's creations. The moral ideas are also willed by God. The strong idea of will was introduced into this tradition by Duns Scotus, and even though Scotus retreated from some of the consequences of this position, he wrote, quote, "The divine will is the cause of good, and so by the fact that he wills something, it is good." Even if Scotus does retreat from the implications of this position, Ockham, that's William of Ockham, does not. For Ockham, moral values are indeed arbitrary and totally dependent on God's will. To know what is good, we must simply find out what God has willed at that time. And the examples now I'm going to give you are Ockham's own examples. Fornication is wrong only because God says so. If God changed his mind and ordered fornication, it would then be good and right. Right now, hatred of God, stealing, and committing adultery are forbidden by God. But they could be ordered by God, and then they would be desirable and meritorious. Of course, in the current moral order, in the world in which we live, such acts are not condemned, and Ockham did not intend to recommend immorality. But he did want to emphasize the complete liberty and total omnipotence of God. In what Father Copleston calls arbitrary divine authoritarianism, Ockham would make piety pious only because it is willed or loved by God, and that love or will could change if God changed his mind. Now, most writers in this Orthodox Christian tradition have not wanted to adopt the full implications of the position as Ockham does. Aquinas, for example, does not attribute natural or moral law to the will of God, but rather to the being or the nature of God. He does not say that moral law depends solely on the arbitrary will of God. Still, for Aquinas, all matter is created by God. It does not derive from anything else, and, quote, presupposes the non-being which is nothing. So that's why everything is created out of nothing, or out of nothing rather, but God. Moreover, all law emanates from God, or, quote, the ruler who governs a perfect community. And this includes the moral law. The Ten Commandments are what they are because they contain the very intention of God. And those are Aquinas' exact words. And as a result, not even God can give dispensations for transgressions of these of the Decalogue. There is nothing totally independent of God. All is contingent on God. The universe and the moral order is what it is because of God, and not because it somehow existed eternally with God and was recognized and adopted by God. That's the first tradition, which Aquinas does not adopt. What is the Mormon position in these two traditions? The answer would seem to be an easy one, because the modern-day scriptures of Mormons deny the ex nihilo creation. For example, Doctrine and Covenants section 93 reads, "Man was also in the beginning with God. Intelligence, or the light of truth, was not created or made, neither indeed can be." In this same section, we learn further, the elements are eternal. To this, Joseph Smith adds in his masterful King Follett discourse that when men teach the unscriptural idea that God made the world out of nothing, quote, "they are unlearned in the thing of God," end quote. The prophet further instructs that the Hebrew words used in the Genesis account mean to organize, and that God had materials to organize the world out of chaos. Chaotic matter, which is element. Element had an existence from the time he had. Now, part of that was a direct quotation from the King Follett discourse. Not only is there element pre-existing with God, but man exists on the same self-existent principle, and these minds or intelligences are eternal, for, quote, "there never was a time when there were not spirits, for they are co-equal or co-eternal with our Father in heaven." James E. Talmage tells us in Jesus the Christ and also the Articles of Faith, that such intelligence was not conglomerate, but individual. For, quote, the spirits of men existed as individual intelligences of varying degrees of ability and power. Parley P. Pratt, in The Key to the Science of Theology, emphasizes the independent existence of forces when he writes, there has always existed a boundless infinitude of space, and, quote, intermingled with this space there exist all of the varieties of elements which are eternal, uncreated, self-existing, and which, quote, possess in themselves certain inherent properties or attributes, end quote. B.H. Roberts, in the 70s course on theology, a work that was produced over 5 years, and in my view is currently too seldom read because of its relative inaccessibility, adds to Pratt's discussion of elements that man, as Joseph Smith expressed it, is, quote, an intelligent entity, uncreated, self-existent, indestructible. Roberts goes on to discuss both natural and moral law and suggests they are similar in that there are laws for both. Quote, the prophet of the new dispensation, as we have seen, taught the doctrine of the reign of law in God's universe, not alone in the physical or natural universe, but as well in the spiritual and moral phases of the universe, end quote. In this law, and this is unlike the Occamite tradition, there is no arbitrariness, as Robert says, nor capriciousness, today one thing, tomorrow another. Roberts makes absolutely clear that this law is not somehow created by God when he writes, quote, but the deeper and truer view of things will be not to accept this reign of law as God, nor mistake it for deity. For mistake it would be if confounded with God. Let the reign of law be conceived rather as the means through which God is working to the achievement of his high purposes, God in the world and working through law. This position seems so clear and so unambiguous that one is perplexed to see Mormon writers waffling between the two horns of the Platonic cleavage, the two traditions that I've discussed. It seems certain that Mormons are clearly in the first tradition and adopt a position much like that of Plato. Although Hiram Andrus, in his God, Man, and the Universe, seems to agree with that position, developed as the Mormon position above, he does so when he writes the following. He, God, cannot create in the sense of originating from nothing, the primal life within living organisms, nor can he bring matter into being out of nothing. Furthermore, truth and consistency impose certain legitimate restrictions upon God's use of his power, end quote. But still, after saying this, I am utterly bewildered when he goes on the very same page to say, thus, in the ultimate sense, all life is subordinate to him and is dependent on him. That's the other tradition. He may as well have been a good Catholic when he said that. Now, I worry if he is using dependent here, as is used in the second tradition, to mean contingent and utterly sustained by God, then he has effectively abandoned that first tradition. I worry further when I read just over the page of Andrus's book language that derives from Plotinus and was taken over and used by St. Augustine in the second tradition, one that I've said is not the Mormon tradition, but the Orthodox Christian tradition, when Andrus writes, quote, the truth which emanates, and that word emanate is a neo-Platonistic word, the truth which emanates from his present and gives God honor that he can possess all power within the cosmos. One cannot have it both ways. Either God has all power, or the elements, space, intelligence, man has some power, exist independent of God, and even God is conditioned by these things. Now, if these strange zigs and zags occurred in only one writer, namely Andrus, one could write them off to inattention or infelicitous expression. but they occur so frequently and in so many different places that the suspicion arises that some writers of them have simply not understood the true traditions. We would call this position, I guess, Mormon zig and zagism. Emotionally, some Mormon writers still want to be absolutistic about God, and as Sterling McMurrin has so aptly suggested, they quote, this is a brilliant phrase, they lust after the linguistic fleshpots of orthodoxy, end quote. Now, if we have the two traditions sorted out fairly well, it may have perplexed some of you that I have been speaking of natural and moral law in one breath, or to see them combined as Roberts did combine them. The idea that there is an eternal moral law or a natural law concerning morality is not much discussed by anyone in philosophy anymore and would be entirely discounted by some philosophers. Besides, the concept of law in natural law and moral law does seem to be a different one. And here I wish I had the blackboard, but we can't get the screen out of the way. Let us call natural laws descriptive laws and distinguish them from prescriptive laws. Now, prescriptive laws would be laws like traffic laws. They are laid down or prescribed by someone. For prescriptive laws, it seems clear that they are conventional and arbitrary. They can be violated. People can drive through traffic lights. Punishment for their violation makes sense. Since they can be violated, it does make sense to punish them. And they could even be abolished under some circumstances. For example, we now stop on red at traffic lights and go on green. Surely we could conventionally change this and stop on green and go on red, if we all agreed to do this. Furthermore, we could abolish this convention and replace all red lights by octagonal signs. Or perhaps we could abolish them if we had streets everywhere as exist in modern-day Brasilia, in Brazil. You know that the intersections all have roundabouts so that there are no stop signs. Everyone is simply merging with the traffic at all times. To summarize then, prescriptive laws are conventional, arbitrary, laid down and promulgated by some agent. They can be violated, punishment for them makes sense, and they can be abolished. Now, natural laws, by contrast, or descriptive laws, don't have these characteristics. Since they purport only to describe the world and not prescribe anything, they are not conventional or arbitrary. They are not laid down by any agent, unless it is God, and this would be universally true only in the second tradition, you understand. They cannot be violated in any ordinary sense of the word, and therefore punishment for them does not make sense. They also cannot be abolished under ordinary circumstances, and perhaps in a correct sense, under no circumstances. For example, laws of gravity describe forces that pervade the universe. One cannot see that Leibniz's suggestion of other possible worlds is even coherent for them, if it were to mean that gravity would not exist in other worlds. Does one ever violate the laws of gravity or the law of gravity? I answer no. One can utilize thrusts, etc., to offset the laws of gravity, but the force is still in operation and the law simply describes how the operation works. Now, there are clearly consequences to certain actions that one can take with regard to descriptive laws. Jumping off of cliffs, for example, will not be healthy. Not because one is violating the law of gravity, but because through one's action, gravity is in operation at all times. Such descriptive laws cannot be violated. Now, we have prescriptive laws and descriptive laws. What is the situation with moral laws? Are they more like descriptive laws or prescriptive laws? This is not just an idle conceptual inquiry. For if they turned out to be completely prescriptive, where they are prescribed by some agent, it would be easier to fit them into the second Orthodox Catholic tradition. On the other hand, if one wants to assert that they are independent of God, then one wants to move them over into the tradition of descriptive or natural laws. Now, to assert the legitimacy of the first tradition, that is, the independent tradition, one would have to argue that at least some of these are not dependent on any person or agent. It does seem clear that all moral or religious values, laws, and so on, can be violated. One can commit murder. One can commit adultery, bear false witness, and so on. Punishments would therefore seem to be appropriate. Would these punishments have to be administered by agents? What I'm suggesting here is they have some characteristics in common with prescriptive laws in that they are promulgated, they can be violated, punishments make sense, but do they have any characteristics in common also with natural laws? Would punishments have to be administered by an agent? Is there any sense, perhaps a Kantian one, in which murder or lying is not arbitrary or conventional, and in which they do have inexorable consequences independent of agents, including God, even if these are not immediately apparent? This is the sort of position that one would have to maintain in order to argue that moral laws do have some affinity with natural or descriptive laws. It is a position that one would have to defend if one wanted to defend the first tradition as applying to moral laws. How this is to be done, I leave open as a challenge for Mormons, who, I believe, do want to defend the first tradition and must do so if they are true to their theological tradition. Thank you.
It's amazing to me that we have two papers that were so similar in their content and intentions in this discussion, as Kent Robson's and mine are. I think it's appropriate to view my question, my paper, as accepting the challenge which Brother Robson gave to defend our view of moral law as falling within the first tradition, and I intend to do that now. Okay. Religion is often viewed functionally as performing two important roles in the life of a believer. First, the explanation of the physical phenomena, interpreting the universe, man's existence, and often the events of history and daily life. And the second function, the justification of a way of life, providing both the grounds for belief in a moral code and the motivating reasons for obeying that code. My contention in this paper is that the Mormon view of God and his relationship to man eliminates God's ability to play a substantial part in the second functional role of religion, the provision and justification of a moral code. Morality in Mormonism is independent of the will and dictates of God. First, let me acknowledge that Mormon thinking on such questions as the nature of God and man and their relationship to each other is not entirely univocal. You may have heard that already today. To choose the central doctrines outlined here, I choose the central doctrines that I'm going to outline and sort of apply to the realm of morality, because I find them stimulating, internally coherent, and consistent with the main body of Latter-day Revelation, much of which has been cited already, and because I feel that it is primarily by exploring those points at which Mormonism may differ from Orthodox Christianity that a Mormon may hope to contribute to theological discussion. Okay. One central precept in Mormon theology holds that man and God are the same type of being. Both are ontologically independent, self-existent, dependent on no other being for their origin and continued existence. They are of equal and infinite antiquity. I'm going to argue for this next one, I think. I won't assert it boldly. Both are subject to law, natural and moral. There are, of course, many important differences between God and man, but these do not concern the essence of either. And I mean essence in sort of a technical way. I'm using the term God here as a name, not as a title. God is perfect, is perhaps a necessary truth, only when God is used as a title. That is, perfection is essential to Godhood, but not to God himself, essential. He would still be who he is if he weren't. He hasn't always been perfect, we assume. It follows from all of this that God did not create the universe out of nothing, but rather, as the King Follett Discourse explains it, found himself in it. Another central doctrine concerns the purpose of earth life. God arranged for us to experience this life so that we might gain opportunities for moral development and progression. The nurturing of this moral growth, which will lead us to greater fulfillment, power, and happiness, is God's overriding purpose in dealing with us. And when I talk about the purpose of life, I mean God's purpose in creating it, in creating this earth life. Since sometimes you wonder whether things that just exist, like life, have purposes. I mean the purpose of that person who created it. Okay, I think, and have argued elsewhere, that this doctrine of God and man simplifies significantly the task of the Mormon apologist faced with such traditionally difficult problems for the Orthodox theologian as the existence of evil and suffering in the universe of a God who supposedly wants to get rid of them. But here I wish to consider a problem which, in principle at least, most of Christianity appears to have solved quite neatly, but which may be more difficult for Mormonism. The problem concerns the justification or grounds of moral obligation. How can there be moral laws? How can it be that some acts are right and some wrong, that there is a real obligation on us to act in some ways and to avoid others? Are there general, unifying principles behind whatever duties we may have? Can we say in some general way what makes right acts right and wrong acts wrong? Often, in Orthodox religious thinking, it is said that such and such is wrong because God has declared it to be so. This is his universe, and he makes the rules. While this may look at first blush like a pretty facile explanation of the grounds of duty, we must keep in mind the Orthodox view of the relationship between God and man. Man is wholly God's creature and utterly dependent, contingent on him. He owns us. To refuse to acknowledge his moral sovereignty is to set one's will against the ground of its very being. Man's moral status as subject is based on the firm ground of his ontological status as creature. Okay. What defense of moral obligation can be made within Mormonism? The tactic of saying that God owns the universe and has, therefore, absolute authority over everything in it does not seem to be available to the Mormon theologian. In fact, a quick glance at the outlines of Mormon doctrine leaves one wondering how God could ever have authority over other self-existent beings in whose presence he found himself. It is, on the other hand, remarkable and perplexing, Brother Robson has shown that he was perplexed by it, that a religion which attributes to man essential independence from God should have schooled a people with such reverence for God's will that Sterling McMurrin could say that Mormons share with Puritans a profound conviction of the moral sovereignty of God. This phrase, the moral sovereignty of God, will come up several times, and it's best that we define it clearly. God is a moral sovereign if and only if, whenever he wills or decrees that we should do X, he thereby, and solely because of his will or decree, morally obligates men to do X. Let us begin by inquiring after this alleged sovereignty. Might moral obligation, even for Mormons, be founded on our relationship to God? The Mormon rejects the contingency of man on God, and God's right to command will have to be based on some other ground. But we do not normally suppose that one person can either by the mere exercise of his will or issuing of a command or order morally obligate another. Their souls would have to stand in some very special relationship, such as creator-creature, before such an exercise of will or such a command should have a binding effect. In all earthly relationships where we might be inclined to say that such an obligation could occur, for example, the relationship between employer and employee, between an officer and a private in the armed forces, something like that. In all those cases, the binding force of the one person's will on the other, if it exists at all, seems to be conditioned on an explicit or implicit promise, I will do as I'm instructed, made by the moral subject, the employee or the private. The promise and the relationship that the two people stand in seem conditioned upon each other. If the relationship were terminated, the promise would be void, and the moral binding authority which rested on that promise would disappear. Okay, I delay briefly the consideration of obligations arising from promises. It's necessary here only to recognize that it seems that all earthly cases of one individual being able to morally obligate another by his mere will or command are based on such promises. I'll talk about promises later. There is, however, a significant difference between our earthly relationships and our relationship with divinity. We may not owe God our very existence, but it can hardly be denied within Mormon theology that we owe him a great deal. Perhaps we can make some argument similar to to the one available to the Orthodox theologian, based on what we do owe him, such as our physical bodies and our earthly life with its peculiar opportunities for progression. Might he not have the right to command how we use our bodies and the opportunities we are given here? I think that an analogy will illuminate this. Suppose a young woman, to fulfill her desires for an education and for greater social development, needs a car. She is, we will stipulate, utterly incapable of providing a car for herself, but she wants one badly. A very rich and generous man sees her need and secretly gives her a car, which she finds in her driveway one morning, fully equipped with her owner's certificate, registration, license, and keys. Amazed but delighted, she prepares to drive off when a man walking down the street interrupts her to say, "By the way, the man who gave you this car insists that you never use the right rear door." Surprised, she asks whether her using that door would result in her losing the car. "No," comes the reply. "Would it have any effect on my prerogatives in driving the car?" Again, "No." "Must I promise to obey this demand as a condition of receiving or using the car?" Once more, "No." Baffled, she enters the car, probably by the left front door, and drives off. Is the woman morally obligated never to use the right rear door? Could she be held to have committed a real moral transgression if she did use it? Most of the people that I've asked this question of say no. And I think that the answer is no. No real moral obligation has been created. The woman made no promises, explicit or implicit, in accepting or operating the car, and there were no conditions to her receiving it. It might be objected, and this, in fact, was my initial reaction when I thought about this example, it might be objected that the gratitude which one ought to feel at receiving a gift entails obedience to the wishes of the giver concerning at least the use of the gift. That is, it would be wrong not to feel a particular kind of gratitude upon receiving a gift. But in considering this objection, it's crucial to remember the level on which we are reasoning. We are trying to discover whether God can make things right or wrong at all. To cite this particular duty, the obligation to feel of gratitude entailing obedience, in this context of trying to find out whether there are any duties at all dependent on God, is either to assume one of the things that we're trying to prove, or to exalt the obligation to feel this kind of gratitude to the status of an ultimate moral principle, at least so far as earthly existence is concerned. But it seems to me that the supposed obligation to obey the wishes of a giver of a gift is at least as suspect and in need of defense as those obligations it is being used to defend. Without appeal to any such obligations of gratitude, respect, or obedience, it is hard to believe that the woman is really under a moral obligation to avoid using the right rear door of her own car. So I conclude that God's will or command is, by itself, insufficient to obligate us. That's crucial. We are essentially co-equal, that's Joseph Smith's word, with God. And binding our wills by His is not one of His prerogatives. Since no other agent can morally bind our will to obey His, it's natural to ask whether we ourselves can do this. There are within Mormonism at least two ways in which it could be proposed that we could have done this. The first is a premortal promise. There may at some point in our eternal existence have come a time when there was some potential blessing so great that we promised God we would obey Him if He would give us that blessing. A prime candidate for such a blessing is the opportunity to enter mortal existence. It might be proposed by some people that, in fact, we made a promise to God that we would obey Him if we could come to this earth. We may, in fact, have made that. But at least one of the necessary conditions for holding a person bound by his promises is that he knows, or at least believes, that he made the promise. Such a promise, made by all persons before this life, could not then serve as a grounds for God's right to command. I'm left to conclude that since neither God's will nor our own, exercised in an unremembered past, can obligate us to obey God's commands, there is no general defense applicable to all persons of the moral sovereignty of God. But before I leave the consideration of obligations based on promises, I must examine one other sort of promise. It's interesting to me that within a church whose doctrine places so much emphasis on the moral independence of each person, there should have reemerged such a strong emphasis on covenant-making as is found in Mormonism. For current purposes, it's sufficient to stipulate that a covenant is something made on earth and includes a promise on the part of some person to obey God, either in some specific set of commandments or in general. Might Mormon strong feelings of the obedience they owe God be justified by the covenants they have made to obey him? Once again, we seem to be invoking one moral principle as a grounds for all the others. The fact that it is wrong to break promises makes it wrong to disobey God. But we must then ask what makes it wrong to break promises. While I admit that promise breaking has more of the flavor of a fundamental principle of morality than does obeying the wishes of a gift giver, the binding force of promises still stands in need of some ground independent of the will of God. If all our obligations to obey God are based on further obligations, which God has no role in, and which we make binding on ourselves through our own volition, like covenants, then once again it seems that God lacks genuine moral sovereignty. Right and wrong are essentially independent of the divine will or decrees, and we must look elsewhere for the ultimate justification of moral obligation. Thus far, my argument for the independence of morality from the will of God has been an essentially negative one, trying to show that, within Mormonism, arguments in favor of the moral sovereignty of God are untenable. There may be a more direct argument from the nature of God and man to the same conclusion. One aspect of Mormonism's insistence on the essential similarity of God and man is the startling teaching that, as man is, God once was. Although it is hard to know just how literally to take this teaching, if it's true in any meaningful way at all, it entails that God's relationship to morality was once even as ours is now. There were duties, not of his own creation, that were as obligatory on him as any are on us. Now, nowhere in Mormon theology does there exist the idea that God's relationship to morality could have changed over time. Certainly it is assumed that it is no longer much of a struggle for him to do what's right. But this does not mean that he is not subject to the same moral imperatives we are. If he has no need for a moral sovereign to make them binding on him, then neither do we. So we conclude again that morality is independent of the will and word of God. If then commandments... Okay, that's end of section one, and was supposed to do what Brother Robson said we wanted to do. If then commandments are not pieces of moral legislation, they must be viewed as revelations in which God enlightens us concerning truths independent of himself, recommends methods of action which were right even before he said them, as Brother Robson said. Perhaps there is some underlying reason why God reveals them as he does, and we can find in this reason the key to their obligatory force. Having such a rich conception of God's purpose in providing this life for us, Mormons have often sought in that purpose the explanation of God's commandments. From Joseph Smith's declaration that happiness would be the end of this life if we obey those principles, the commandments, which lead to it, through the humblest sacrament meeting talk, Mormon discourse is replete with the idea that God knows what will make us happy, and he gives commandments to guide us in those ways. I had a good story about that, but we don't have time for it. There are quasi-natural laws which govern our ability to grow and be happy. For example, a person who forgives another is freed from torment and hate which impede the development of the ability to love. Knowing these natural laws, God develops moral laws intended to promote growth and happiness. For example, thou shalt forgive all men. This view of commandments I will call the roadmap to growth and happiness view. I would like to discuss two problems with this view of moral law. The first is an especially acute version of a general problem with teleological ethics, that is, ethics which judges the rightness of actions and personality traits according to the goodness of the results toward which they tend to lead, results goal-oriented ethics. Let's assume for a moment this roadmap to happiness view of moral law, and further assume that one of the things that will make us happiest is to be unselfish, to seek not our own. Now it seems reasonable to require of a teleological, that is, results-oriented ethical system, that the results it seeks to maximize, the results on which it judges actions, may be held as the goals of morally worthy agents. Phrased another way, it may be a test of the moral worthiness of people that they should have, let's say, a test of the morally worthy people, that they should have as their own ends those ends toward which teleological duties point. Is that clear? That commandments are directed at some end in the teleological system. they're supposed to promote happiness, or they're supposed to promote utility, if you've heard of utilitarianism, that there's some end towards which these things are pointed. And it's reasonable to think, at least, that a person who, if teleological ethics is right, that a person who is righteous is one whose ends conform to those same ends which the laws aim at, and therefore can conform his actions naturally to them. In the case of the roadmap to happiness view of morality, then a righteous person would be seeking his own growth and happiness, his own benefit. But there's something paradoxical at best, and more likely downright contradictory, about being selfless in order to benefit yourself. So while moral laws point at one set of ends, in order to actually fulfill those ends, we must often avoid being philosophers and obey them as if they pointed at other ends or at no ends at all. While this is a sorry state for a moral theory, it may not be decisive against it. My second objection, I hope, is. Consider what we are saying when we condemn someone for breaking a moral law. I contend that we're not merely saying, see here, you've done something to hurt yourself, to limit your own growth and happiness. The problem is that the roadmap to happiness version of moral law seems to reduce morally binding commandments to mere counsels of prudence, what Kant calls hypothetical imperatives. These have the form, if you want X, then do Y. Part of the problem with hypothetical imperatives in ethics is that they have no more claim to govern our actions and tell us to do Y than we have desire to obtain X. And when there is no moral obligation to obtain X, we are free not to do Y. If you don't care about growing and being happy, you have no need to forgive others. But our general idea of moral law that we hold sort of naively is that it is binding on everyone, irrespective of their desires. We don't get to pick and choose which laws apply to us. Thus, the commandments as good advice aspect of the roadmap to happiness version of morality is inconsistent with our intuitions about the universal obligatory force of moral laws. Disobedience is sin, not just imprudence. But this does not necessarily disqualify this notion of morality. In the absence of any more comprehensive or illuminating moral theory, it's hard to know which of these two competing beliefs to abandon, either the idea that God commands just because it's going to make us happy, or the idea that moral laws are always binding on everybody. Indeed, the view that hypothetical imperatives, if you want this, then get this, are all there is to morality seems consistent with the relatively naturalistic Mormon view of the universe and the Mormon notion of the teleological and oriented purpose of life. I wish that I could decide which of those things to give up. Okay. But I think that they're pretty sound criticisms of the idea that all moral laws there are directions about how to... I mean, the idea of that kind of a moral law is one that says, don't jump off a cliff. Okay? And the problem with that is that if you don't care whether you break your leg, then you can jump off a cliff. Having been mainly critical and destructive up to this point, I would like to present a hint at a direction we might explore for more insights into a constructive, synthetic approach to Mormon ethics. I take as my text, since now I'm sermonizing, an apocryphal Mormon saying of some currency, obedience is the first law of heaven. How many people have ever heard that in church? Okay, I'm not alone. I think that this saying, which I have long detested, admits of at least three possible interpretations. The first interprets obedience as obedience to authority, primarily God, sometimes not. I hope that my discussion of the moral relationship between ourselves and God has shown that it cannot be our primary duty to submit ourselves to another will. Such an interpretation is also inconsistent with the notion of moral development, which I boldly assert includes increasing self-sufficiency and self-determination of the individual. The second interpretation, robbed of the first, understands the obedience in obedience is the first law of heaven as obedience to laws in general, that is, to the rest of the laws of heaven. This, however, is not a law in itself, but merely a restatement of the fact that the other laws are laws. Obedience in this sense isn't a law, but something you do to a law. The third interpretation is that it is from the very concept of obedience to law, that all the laws of heaven may be derived. If you didn't recognize it already, I might as well admit that this is stolen from Kant, because it'll become obvious soon enough. What matters most in the Mormon universe is not so much the moral status of the actions that get performed as the moral status of the agents who are performing them. What is crucial in determining the moral worthiness of an individual is not so much the actions which he performs as his reasons for performing them, that is, the motivations or principles which govern him or by which he governs his actions. So, if in a moral theory we are seeking a standard by which to judge actions, this standard will evaluate not the action itself, but rather the reason it is being performed. Now, the reason or subjective ground from which we are acting can always be expressed as some kind of a rule. For example, if you're going to be embarrassed, avoid the situation. Or always seek to make others happy. Okay, those are guidelines, rules that people could act out of. So it is these subjective rules by which we act which are the proper objects of moral evaluation, I contend. They have the form of laws, and our actions, they have the form of laws. And our actions are morally worthy if those subjective rules out of which they are performed accord with universal moral laws. But since this sort of standard, this is being proposed as the fundamental criterion of the morality of action, logically prior to the existence of any substantive moral laws, that is, ones that talk about embarrassing situations or making other people happy, since this is being proposed as a fundamental criterion of the morality of actions before any such laws exist, conformity of the rules behind our actions with moral law can only mean that the rules are worthy to be made into moral laws themselves. So the agent, to act rightly, must examine the reasons for his own actions and ask whether he can will that they should be universal laws. Should sound familiar. This is true obedience to law in the general sense, and it becomes the mother of all the laws of heaven. Acting in accordance with this view of morality, we discover, and in some sense create, our own moral laws. This notion of morality involves the agent in determining for himself what is right through developing moral sensitivity and through committing himself to moral principles rather than submitting himself to a code or another will. This process enhances the self-realization and moral development which God purposed in providing this early earthly existence. Well, if you noticed, I proposed that morality has much more to do with the will of the individual who's acting than it does with God. Let me conclude with a final defense of my belief that, as strange and initially uncomfortable as it may seem within a faithful religion, the view that the foundation of morality is completely independent of the will and decrees of God has much to recommend it. First, even though the doctrine of the moral sovereignty of God, which he would be the reason for moral for actions being moral or immoral, even though that seems to provide a strong foundation for morality, there are great dangers in the doctrine. For one thing, it seems to run the risk of severely compromising what we mean by right and good. It reduces the important religious assertion, God is good, to something like, God does what God decrees, or God wills what God decrees should be done. This is hardly what we mean by God is good. It also robs God of the possibility of genuine moral decision-making. Since whatever he wills is right, he can never discover what he ought to will or do. While this implication of the alleged moral sovereignty of God is uncomfortable enough for Orthodox religion, it would be disastrous for Mormonism, which insists that, in principle at least, and possibly after Gene England's talk this afternoon, in fact, the individual referred to by the title God can learn and discover truth and moral right. God is good in that he too has learned obedience and conformed himself to the moral law. Finally, acknowledging that the ultimate responsibility for determining right and wrong lies with each individual seems more likely to lead to a rich, fertile moral life. We must work out our own salvation. Our progression consists in developing our moral intuitions and capacities, rote obedience to another will or even to a prescribed code, is severely limited in its ability to promote this end, which is supposedly the end of this earth's life. It is best for our eternal happiness and progression that we develop our capacity to make moral discriminations and choices through personal moral struggle and the development and refinement of our own moral faculties.
Sessions like these will surely test your love of theology. If I can understand, if those of you have other commitments, it is past 12 o'clock. Robson's paper, as well as McCall's, deal with similar issues, but I'd like to deal with each of them separately. It'll be clear in certain cases where they have similar arguments or similar questions. How they relate. Professor Robson is doing essentially this, as I understand it, identifying two main views of the dependence, the relationship between moral values and principles, and on one hand, and God on the other, and tracing those traditions, and then determining in which of those traditions Mormon theology would fall, which of those views, if either, Mormon theology is committed to. And then he draws some implications from that view. I don't have any particular quarrels with anything that he has said about the distinction between those. It seems to me that he has explained it in a very straightforward way, in a clear way. I do want to emphasize the radical nature of the idea that values are dependent upon God. This is a very strong dependence. It's not, as he mentioned, that God is always correct about moral values, that is, he knows what they are and he's not mistaken. Even that he's necessarily right is not the view. It's not the view that we will never err if we do what God commands us to do. Nor is it the view that we must rely on God in order to know what is right or is wrong. All of those views, that we are dependent upon God to know what is right or wrong, that it is useful to do so, that he's always right, those are all compatible with the view that morals are independent from God. Okay? It's a very strong view. The view that morals are dependent upon God is the idea that there is nothing essential to morality over and above God's command. That's it. Not happiness, not justice, not truth-telling, anything else. Those may be the effects of the command, but those are not essential to morality. They may happen to accompany it as God's command. So it's a view which we may adopt on first hearing it, and may think we hold, but it is stronger than we perhaps want to acknowledge. I just have one minor comment on Robson's claim that Mormon theology is committed to the independence view, the idea that morals and God are not dependent upon one another, and that is that he seems to argue from the premise that the elements and spirits and other items of the universe are uncreated. And from that, he seems to hold that the independence view follows. That, of course, is not strictly true. It's conceivable one might maintain that God's commands did, in fact, constitute morality, and still think that the rest of the universe is uncreated. Creation ex nihilo might be viewed as simply creation of the stuff, the furniture of the universe, and not moral laws. It, of course, often has, but need not. I say this because very few Mormon writers address the question of the source of moral laws, whether or not God created them, it seems to me. Roberts mentions it explicitly, but in all the other sections, there are many references, of course, to the universe as being uncreated, but not to moral laws. And those are separate logical questions, even though, of course, they're congenial to one another, and one would likely adopt both, but need not. Also, I'd like to add parenthetically, that the dependence view does seem to be viewed, does seem to be held by many Mormon writers and perhaps members of the church generally, though it's rarely articulated, and may stem simply from the belief that, as I mentioned earlier, that God must be relied upon to know what is right or that God is necessarily right. We can't always understand what to do in a certain case and need to find out from him. But as I mentioned earlier, that doesn't commit one to the dependence view. One can still have the independence view. One other aspect of Robson's paper I'd like to comment on, and that is that his claim that if you hold the independence view, then you're committed to a view of moral principles as descriptive. Okay? He's saying that, first of all, Mormon theology is committed to the idea that moral principles are independent of God, just like molecules and spirits are independent of God. And he says, furthermore, that if that's true, that being committed to that view also commits one to the view that moral laws are descriptive or at least have an affinity, as he says, toward two descriptive laws. Now, the argument, as I see it in his paper, might be that prescriptive laws require an agent, while descriptive laws do not. Well, now that is a difference. But while this is evidence that the independence view is not compatible with a prescriptive view, it's no reason to think that moral laws must be descriptive. The prescriptive-descriptive dichotomy is not exhaustive, okay? You might maintain that moral laws are, in fact, something else altogether again. They're neither descriptive, they're not like laws of nature, and they're not like statutes. In fact, that seems to me the true view. Laws of morality are such as lying is wrong, happiness ought to be promoted, and so on. Those are not the form of statutes. Those are not legislated laws. They need not be arbitrary, for example, and they do contain value terms, which is essential to moral laws, and legislated statutes do not contain value terms. In general, it seems to me that moral laws, it's implausible that moral laws are like laws of nature, primarily because they do contain ethical terms. One might attempt to reduce them to laws of nature, which some people have tried to do, but on the face of it, they're not the same thing. Robson goes on to say something else in this connection, and that is that if moral principles are descriptive, then such immoral acts as murder, for example, would have, as he says, inexorable consequences independent of agents. He's mapping out now what it would be like for moral principles to be descriptive. Well, one way in which they'd be descriptive is to be about consequences of a murder, say, or other immoral acts. Now, such a principle would indeed be a descriptive law, but it would not be a moral law for just the reasons I mentioned. It would be a law of nature, or at least a kind of a generalization about the nature of certain kinds of actions. Murder has certain kinds of consequences. That may be the nature of the commandments that God gives us, but they're not moral principles. As Kim pointed out, those are hypothetical imperatives, and they don't have the binding force that an ethical principle does. I think that's all that I want to say about Professor Robson's paper. I'll abbreviate my comments on Kim McCall's paper. Kim starts out looking for a justification for ethical principles that might be available by an appeal to the commands of a God of Mormonism. That is there any justification for moral principles that makes them binding or that justifies them? This certainly is the overarching question in at least philosophical aspects of moral theory. How do you justify ethical theories, ethical principles? Why do they have any binding force? He seems to me to conclude that there is no theological justification. And he seems relatively pleased about that because it gives agents some sort of freedom and independence and moral creativity and so on. But there is still the problem of justification. So what he seems to have reduced his task not for the justification in general of moral principles, which is still a problem, even for the independence view. Even if you think that this roadmap to happiness view is the correct one, you still have the problem of justification left. But at least you do have the argument, according to McCall, that there is no separate theological justification, that there is no necessary tie. So his paper can be viewed as an argument that moral principles are independent. Make just one comment that I think may be worth making, that this inquiry about ultimate moral principles is unusual in Mormon theology. As much as we're concerned or think we're concerned with ultimate moral principles and right behavior, very few inquiries of that nature are made. I'm not sure exactly why that's true. Perhaps it's because we do endorse a dependence view, mistakenly. We think that that is the ground of morality. But perhaps it's also because we think that it's arrogant or unnecessary to inquire after the ultimate justification of moral principles. However, knowledge of moral principles, ultimate moral principles, does not require complete knowledge of why a particular act is wrong or why it is right. As one needn't be arrogant, one needn't be omniscient in order to have a knowledge of what the ultimate reasons are. It can also be argued that knowledge of ultimate moral principles is necessary for rational moral decision. And this goes even for the cases of obedience, the well-known cases of Adam and sacrifice in the Garden of Eden, and Abraham and his son Isaac. Those are compatible with understanding what the ultimate moral principles are. It might be that one holds that God wishes our happiness, we ought to be happy, and that whatever God commands us brings us happiness. In fact, I suspect that that view is held rather widely in the church. We can still hold those views about obedience and still inquire what the ultimate moral principles are. It might be that Abraham knew what the ultimate moral principle was, whether it was happiness, whether it was some view of justice or obligation, whether it was a contract theory, whatever, and he knew that what God commanded him to do satisfied that principle. He may not have known why or how it satisfied the principle, but he knew, he may have known, I don't know, he may have known that at least it satisfied the principle, because he had faith that God existed and knew the principles himself. Kim gives up the contract theories because they don't essentially involve God, and I think that there is something to that, though I think that's not obvious and needs further argument. He claims, for example, that promises can be made to oneself or other individuals and not God. Those are not essentially theological justifications. I'm not sure about that. I think a more severe difficulty for this kind of a contract theory is that it's not clear that all moral obligation can be reduced to such contracts. That's a very tall order. What you want is to have all of our values, virtues, ethical principles to reduce to covenants we've made with God or somebody else. And that, of course, is a large order. Kim hasn't pretended to do that. And it's doubtful to me whether it can be done. But that's a difficulty. Kim seems ultimately then to settle on what he calls the the guidebook to happiness, the roadmap to happiness. This is the view, essentially, or at least is it a species of view that moral principles are really independent of God, that we're on a par with respect to moral principles, that God essentially communicates these to us. He tells us what makes us happy, and that's what the commandments are. Again, there seems to be some ambivalence in the paper. It's not clear that Kim is very happy with that, because he says these really don't have binding force. They're essentially like hypothetical imperatives, and they don't have binding force. I'm not sure what Kim wants to do here, whether he wants to say that their ethical principles do not need justification or do not need binding force, or that simply we need to look further for the justification of the ultimate principles, say, of happiness, or whatever. He seems to think, though, that there are some advantages in this view. I want to make just one a comment on some of his arguments for the independence of ethical principles from God. Just one of those arguments. If If moral principles are dependent upon God, then God cannot discover moral truths. He simply, you know, watches what he does, and that's the way he finds out. That seems an absurd view. And I think that's to some extent right. But it does, the argument of Kim's does presuppose the idea that moral truths are to be discovered, and that's quite controversial, and I'm not sure that it's true. The major argument in favor of independence of moral principles from God is that in some way we are, our capacity to make decisions and moral discrimination and choices is enhanced. We somehow have freedom that's greater than if moral principles were dependent upon God. That's at least not obvious to me. We feel the weight of obedience, perhaps, that it is compelling, but I think it need not be. I'm not positive about this because there certainly is a less moral reasoning on the dependence view. If what is morally right simply means no more than God's commands, then one needn't think as much, perhaps, about what one ought to do. But one still can be a morally mature in the sense of making a decision and can still decide whether or not to be moral. One can decide whether or not to obey God's commands. So it's not as if it's simply an oppressive view that it is coercive. There still is independence left, and I think that needs perhaps further discussion. The general question of the relationship of morals to God is not a dead issue. It's nearly a dead issue. Ethical philosophers have just about either don't discuss it or give it up, and that's partly, I think, because of an anti-theistic bias. There is a recent volume that I'd recommend to you if you're interested in further in this question by Philip Quinn of Brown University. It's a very interesting book in which he defends a modified divine command theory. So I think the question, the discussion is not over, even though I think, and I agree with Kim, that the independence view is, even if it were not orthodox Mormon theology, certainly seems advantageous, seems more intelligible than the divine command view. There are other relationships of God to value which we haven't talked about and which are a subject for another time. Thank you very much.